1 Corinthians chapter 1, we're looking at verses 18 to 25. The foolishness of God, you remember, is the title of this series, looking at the first four chapters of this letter. So we saw last week that there was disunity in the Corinthian church, and disunity of a particularly concerning kind, because it was brazen. The Corinthians weren't embarrassed or ashamed about their quarrels. Disunity took the form in Corinth of church members rallying around different leaders in a very tribal sort of way. And they weren't doing this unconsciously. They weren't subtly getting entangled in this kind of behavior without realizing it. They were pursuing this disunity. They were aspiring to this disunity, because it was a feature of the whole wisdom culture that was such a big thing in their city. Wisdom in Corinth was very much about competing factions, each centered on its own celebrity teacher. And this church then was infatuated with that surrounding culture. In fact, Paul seems to be saying in these early chapters of the epistle, it had supplanted the cross of Christ at the core of their Christianity. Wisdom was eclipsing the gospel of the cross. And we must now ask the question, why was that happening? Why were they letting wisdom supplant the cross? Well, one simple answer is that they had been steeped in that culture prior to conversion. And I guess for many believers down the ages, their pre-conversion past has proved a thorn in the flesh, a source of temptation throughout the Christian life. The Apostle Peter quotes, doesn't he, that rather gross proverb about the dog that returns to its vomit. I'm saying, as former devotees of this wisdom culture, these believers are going to be susceptible to it in a way that you and I might struggle to understand. But there's more to all of this than that. There's a more substantial reason for this shift of emphasis at the heart of their Christianity. And I've tried to capture it then in my first heading this evening. My first heading is the awkwardness of the cross, the awkwardness of the cross. I don't know whether any of you are into the Far Side cartoons by the brilliant Gary Larson. The cartoons are better shown than described, but there's one Far Side cartoon that I want to try to describe to you. It depicts all these dogs at a party, and they're all standing in a room holding their drinks. And the cartoon has two scenes. And in the first scene, there are lots of conversations going on among the dogs, and there are all these speech bubbles coming from them. One dog is saying, "That's a new collar, isn't it, Rusty?" And another is saying, "I hear the Caldwells have got a new cat." And it's all that kind of thing. But as you look at the cartoon and your eye scans from left to right, the last speech bubble reads, "Say, I just found out yesterday I've got worms." And then you have a second scene, which is clearly set just 2 or 3 seconds later, and now there are no speech bubbles. Silence has descended on the party, and all the other dogs are glaring at this dog at the right-hand side of the room, who is now looking decidedly uncomfortable. And the caption underneath the cartoon reads, "Canine social blunders." Perhaps some of Paul's readers could have sympathized with the poor dog in the cartoon there. Imagine you're a first century Corinthian believer and you're at a party. And you get into a conversation, and after initial pleasantries about the weather and the excellent quality of the canapes, it goes something like this. "So I hear you're part of a group that meets every Sunday in someone's house," your conversation partner remarks. "Oh yes," you respond, "you're spot on there. It's this thing called Christianity that I'm into. I'm a Christian. Those gatherings on a Sunday that you mention, they are in order to worship and learn more about Jesus Christ." "Oh," the person says, "I'm intrigued. Tell me who this Jesus Christ is then." Certainly I'll tell you who Jesus Christ is. He's the Son of God who has always existed and who created the universe. Wow, your friend interjects. That sounds pretty cool. Oh yes, you reply, enjoying the reaction and now warming to your theme. And that's not all. Just a few decades ago, this mighty Son of God came down here into our world and lived as a man. Really? Well, that's different. Yes, you affirm. He lived here as a man. He performed loads of the most spectacular miracles. Well, I suppose he would if he were the Son of God on earth, your fellow partygoer agrees. And at this point, you suddenly start to worry a little about the trajectory that your conversation is on, about where you can see it heading. And so you grope for some kind of closure. Yes, anyway, me and my pals on a Sunday, we're really into this Jesus. Now, can I get you another drink? But your conversation partner is absorbed now. No, please don't stop. I want to know what happened to this Jesus. I mean, he performed all these miracles then, but then what? Oh, you say airily, after a while he died. He died? Well, I was expecting something a bit more climactic than that. I guess he must have died then a very glorious, a very heroic kind of death. Well, he died on a cross, actually. And there you have it. There's the I've got worms moment. Suddenly, there's silence throughout the room. Somehow, above the hubbub of numerous conversations at that party, everyone has heard the word cross. And it has stopped them in their tracks. You could feel the gaze of multiple pairs of eyes piercing your cranium. Eventually, your stunned conversation partner speaks up. Okay, when you say on a cross there, I assume you don't mean on a cross. You don't mean that this Son of God, whom you worship, was, excuse my French, crucified. Well, yes, you respond, swallowing hard, but let me explain. But there's no chance now of explaining. You've now ruined the party by saying something so vulgar, bringing crucifixion of all things into a civilized conversation. You're persona non grata in that room now. If you're a Jewish Christian in Corinth, and this is a Jewish social occasion, then you're in even hotter water if you go down that conversational route. And you can see then that there was plenty of incentive to push the cross to the periphery and put something else in its place at the center. I mean, you would have much pleasanter experiences at parties if instead of what I've just described, the conversation could go something like this. Oh, you want to know about my Christianity? Yes, I'd love to tell you about it. Basically, it's all about learning loads of deep stuff from this awesome guy called Apollos. Apollos is just this brilliant scholar. And the way he can speak, if you put him behind a lectern, well, it has to be heard to be believed. Some of the other Christians I know, they're into a different teacher called Paul, but he's vastly inferior. He lives in Apollos' shadow. In fact, what I'll do is I'll take off my jumper and show you my new t-shirt, which has "I follow Apollos" written all over the front of it. In fact, actually, wait a minute. I'll even show you my new upper arm tattoo, depicting Apollos in the act of delivering one of his inspired messages. So there, that gives you an insight into my Christianity that you asked about. And your conversation partner exclaims, "Wow, that's all fantastic. It actually sounds really similar to how things work at the Epicurean society that I belong to. I'd really love to come along someday and join you guys on a Sunday." You get the point. There was something profoundly awkward about the cross in Corinth. It was folly, verse 18. In fact, a stumbling block and folly, verse 23. Put something else at the center, however, and suddenly all the awkwardness has gone. Now, it's not as extreme as that in our context today. The idea of worshipping a crucified man isn't as perverse as it was in that context where crucifixion was such a violation of decency. But even so, The fact is that a Christianity centered on fair trade goods and eco-friendly projects is going to go down an awful lot better with folk than a Christianity centered on the cross of Jesus Christ. I think it's fair to say that, at least. And it all raises the question then, does it not? Why is shifting the focus such a bad thing? If something else occupying the central spot is going to make our Christianity much more popular, then why not go for it? Surely it's a no-brainer. Why keep the cross central when the cross is so downright awkward? Well, our second heading this evening contains the answer. We've considered the awkwardness of the cross. Let's consider, secondly, the accomplishment of the cross. The accomplishment of the cross. You see, the cross might be distasteful. To the first century mind, obscenely so. But this is the thing. It accomplishes something that nothing else can. Our passage twice refers to the concept of saving. That language is used twice. What does it mean? What kind of saving does Paul have in mind? Well, the answer is in verse 21. Look at verse 21. Paul says, "For since in the wisdom of God, the world did not know God through wisdom, it pleased God through the folly of what we preach," that is the cross, "to enable people to know God." That would seem to fit best the logic of the verse, wouldn't it? But that's not what Paul says. He says instead, "Since in the wisdom of God, the world did not know God through wisdom, it pleased God through the folly of what we preach to save." To save. Because presumably then that amounts to the same thing. You see, man's great problem is not knowing God. Man's great problem is not knowing God. I mean, knowing in the strong sense of the word, not being in a relationship with him. That is man's great problem. The last words which millions of people will hear before they are cast into hell are, "I never knew you." Paul writes solemnly in 2 Thessalonians 1 verse 8 about vengeance finally being inflicted on those who do not know God. Here indeed in our passage, the opposite of knowing God is perishing. That's the word Paul uses in verse 18. Do you realize this evening? Man's great problem is not knowing God. That is the dreadful hell-incurring predicament that men and women and boys and girls more than anything else need to be saved from. And the point is then, only the cross can accomplish that. Only the cross can save in that sense. Whatever is put in its place won't. Other things might make for a more comfortable evening at that party we talked about, but other things that we allow to eclipse the gospel of the cross will leave us in a situation where we do not know God, where we have no relationship with him, where we are in fact on the road to hell. So it's not worth it. That's the point. Comfortable evenings at parties is a very small gain compared to what is forfeited when you supplement the cross, when you supplant, the cross of Jesus Christ. One of the great Scottish theologians of the 18th century was a man called John Brown of Haddington. Haddington there a few miles south of Edinburgh. And he wrote these words about God's true people. He wrote, "It matters little to them if the world frowns on them, if he," that is God, "smiles. And it matters little to them that the world smiles if he frowns." That's the outlook of genuine Christianity. God smiles through the cross. It's at the cross that he has been reconciled to sinners. It's at the cross that a smile breaks out on the face of the Almighty. And if the world frowns at the cross, then so be it. the fair trade gospel and the eco-friendly gospel don't secure God's smile. Only the gospel of the cross secures God's smile, and so we'll stick with that and take the world's frowns. That's genuine Christianity. And we need to be praying that God will fill us with that outlook in the days to come. But that raises another question. It raises the question, why did it ever have to be like this? Why couldn't it have been a both-and situation rather than an either-or situation? That is, both God smiling and the world smiling. To put it more simply, why couldn't God have just saved people in a way that would appeal to those folk at the party? If Jews demand signs and Greeks seek wisdom, verse 22, why couldn't God have adapted to that reality and save people in a more seeker-friendly fashion? According to verse 21, it was in the wisdom of God that he very deliberately went down this completely different route instead. He hasn't just ended up somehow, one thing leading to another, accidentally pursuing a salvation route that's so different to what the world would go for. He deliberately did this. He went out of his way, Paul seems to be saying in verse 21, to save in a way that would offend Jews and Gentiles, that is the whole world alike. Why? Why did it have to be by a cross? Why did God have to save in a way that is so awkward to men and women? Well, we could answer that question, couldn't we? Why does God have to save via a cross? We could answer that in a very theological way. We could answer that in terms of the necessity of blood atonement because of God's holiness and justice and the nature of sin and so on. You're all familiar with that kind of logic, and we could stress all of that. But here, actually, another answer emerges. And that takes us to our final heading this evening. We've considered the awkwardness of the cross, we've considered the accomplishment of the cross, but then thirdly and finally, the appropriateness of the cross. The appropriateness of the cross. Let's step back a bit. The story of the human race has been that of trying to be in control. Remember how the great temptation in the Garden of Eden was to be like God. And man succumbed. He didn't want to be a dependent creature. He wanted to be in the driving seat. And he has ever since. We know what is best. We decide what happens. That has been man's attitude throughout the centuries. And it's monstrous. It's outrageous. Because the reality is that God is infinite and eternal. The source of all power and wisdom and goodness. Human beings, on the other hand, are frail and finite, sustained by him every moment of every day. And so, from Eden onwards, God has constantly had to confront this phenomenon. And in verse 19, Paul quotes a particularly striking announcement that God made through the prophet Isaiah. An announcement about how God, in some very decisive fashion, was going to overthrow this control freakery of man. I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the discernment of the discerning I will thwart. And what Paul is saying in our passage is that that prophecy is fulfilled in God's salvation. It's in God's salvation that he does that, that he so strikingly, so decisively overthrows man's control freakery. You see, when God sets about this business of saving people, he didn't set up an advisory committee of the most brilliant human beings to give him some help on how to go about it. He didn't launch a consultation period so that he could benefit from man's stellar contributions. That's the point of those questions that Paul asks so stingingly in verse 20. Where is the one who is wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? In other words, he's saying, where is their input when it comes to God's salvation? And he's saying it's not there at all. If God's salvation were a book, you wouldn't find men's names in the acknowledgements page at the beginning. If God's salvation were a film, you wouldn't find the wise men of this world, their names on the credits at the end. Because God has saved in a way that utterly contradicts all men's ideas and violates all men's instincts. He saves in a way that human beings would never have dreamt up in a million years, a way that is equally antithetical to human beings' intuitions, whether they be Jews or whether they be Greeks. So much so, in fact, that Paul says no human being will ever, in a million years, even stumble accidentally upon God's salvation. And so it has to work by invitation only. God has to call, verse 24. He has to call, he has to invite. He has to summons those who will become participants and beneficiaries in this. And so the cross is deeply appropriate. It fits into this war on human control freakery that God has been engaged in ever since the Garden of Eden. It's the climactic expression of that. God has constantly had to confront this impulse in man to be on the throne, to be in charge. And nowhere does God confront that more spectacularly than when he saves in a way that men just have not contributed to and have not had any input into whatsoever. And so we have verse 25, Paul's great conclusion of this paragraph: for the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. What the bright young Gentiles at that Corinthian party I talked about treated like a dog having worms. Oh dear, what foolishness. What the zealous Jews in Corinth's Hebrew quarters treated similarly. Oh dear, what weakness. We'll stick with the mighty events of the Old Testament, thank you very much. What Gentiles treated as such foolishness, what Jews treated as such weakness, saves people from hell and reconciles sinful men and women to their Maker. And so the cross magnifies God. The cross reveals him to be in control. Him to be the one who decides what happens. Him to be in the driving seat. He's not a pathetic little deity living in his creature's shadow. At the cross, more than anywhere, God declares, I am God and there is no other. I am God and there is none like me. Who else came up with this plan? Who helped me? Who was my counselor and my consultant on this? Nobody. It's my plan. It's got me written all over it. You would never have come up with this, human beings. And so at the cross, God declares his godness like never before. And so it's appropriate. It wouldn't have been appropriate for God to come up with some salvation acceptable to Corinthian partygoers. That would have been a pathetic God. A God who was living in man's shadow. But a God who comes up with this unique, uninventable, unguessable salvation. Cross. That's a real God. That's a reigning God. That's a God in control. The cross is appropriate at the deepest level. And so may we be those then who in our age as we ended last week, keep the cross central. As I said, it's not perverse, perhaps, to our contemporaries in the way that it was in that first century context. But, as I said, it's not something that's going to gain us much of a hearing. There are many other things that would gain us much more of a hearing. But let's not swap the cross for those things. But let's stick with this God-magnifying cross of Calvary. And let's cling to it for all we're worth. Amen. Let's pray.